It sounds that way. Hey, Sherry, this is Noah.
Hi, Noah.
Sorry about the confusion with the technical.
Yeah, you had two sets that were transposed. So.
Yeah.
I'm glad we figured it out.
Okay.
All right, so can everyone can hear me? Did you all hear that the recording has started?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful. Dr. Sherry McKee, delighted to have you on board. Dr. McKee is a professor of psychiatry and the director of the Yale Behavioral Pharmacology Laboratory. She's also clinical director at the Ford Addiction Clinic. Do you pronounce it Ford or Ford D-D-D?
It's Ford. It's short for Forensic Drug Diversion Clinic.
Got it. My name is Bruce Leese. I am president-elect of Division 50 and feel very fortunate to be able to say that. The Society of Addiction Psychologists sponsors this. Again, that's Division 50, and many other things that we hope people on the call will all get involved with. So we have these monthly, and I really would, following that terrific presidential address you gave at APA this year, I've become very interested in your work and would like so much to hear what you are doing in your lab about smoking and a little bit about alcohol, I guess, but a lot about smoking. So take it away. Just talk a little bit about yourself and what you're doing. And it's a good group that often has good questions, so talk as long as you want, and anyone with a question will be happy to jump in.
Yeah, I encourage people to ask me questions as we go along. It always makes it more interesting rather than, me just talking, hearing myself. So I'd love to hear what you guys, feedback you have, questions you have as we go along. So as Bruce mentioned, I'm a professor of psychiatry at Yale School of Medicine. I've been here for almost 20 years. I did my graduate work in Canada where I grew up at the University of Western Ontario, and then moved here for internship and stayed. So I have had a long-standing interest in looking at sex and gender differences with regards to addiction, and I now coordinate a large interdisciplinary group that are focused on informing and expediting the development of gender-sensitive treatments for smoking cessation. So I'll talk a little bit more about the specific work that we're doing, but this work is funded as a P50, which is a center grant mechanism funded by the National Institutes of Health. So center grants are fairly large entities that comprise multiple projects that are all supposed to intersect and also have what are called cores, which provide sort of streamlined functions to the various projects. Like you can have a data analysis core or a laboratory samples core. So in our particular center, we have three interrelated projects, and we have two cores that support the function of the project. So like I said, our primary aim is to focus on developing gender-sensitive treatments, but we also have a training mission, so we are also committed to training the next generation of interdisciplinary and translational researchers. And then another part of having a center grant is that you're supposed to be larger than the sum of your parts. So the way we do that is we are a national resource to invigorate and galvanize the study of sex and gender differences in relation to smoking. So, as I I'm sure some of you appreciate, tobacco use continues to be the leading cause of preventable morbidity and mortality in the United States. So the most recent data on this suggests that smoking contributes to 556,000 premature deaths per year just in the United States, and then that figure balloons to 6 million premature deaths worldwide. And I think sometimes smoking is not as focused on with regards to, you know, what's popular and sort of pressing. I know there's, you know, a lot of recent press about, you know, marijuana use, recent press about, you know, the opiate crisis that we're experiencing in this nation. But I think it's always, you know, and not to say that those research areas aren't critically important, but just to keep in mind that smoking still has this status, and it is still sort of the number one sort of public health concern with regards to addiction. So if you were to put that in contrast to some other basic statistics, so like I said, you know, 556,000 deaths per year, the entire population of Atlanta, for example, is just over 400,000. So the entire population of Atlanta is dying from something each and every year that is completely preventable. So one of the reasons, you know, I focus on women smokers is that they face critical health disparities. And one way that this happens is that they are more likely to suffer from health consequences as a result of smoking. So when you take female and male smokers and equate them for tobacco exposure, female smokers are more likely to develop lung cancers, more likely to develop oral cancers, they're more susceptible to tobacco-related carcinogens, and have increased risk of coronary heart disease as a result of smoking when you compare them to men. And then the other piece of this is that women experience a number of sex-specific health risks that are related to their reproductive health and related to the health of their fetuses. So any questions yet?
Well, you know, of course, this is Bruce. I'm sure you recognize my voice
I
by
do.
Now, Jerry. But already you've gotten me very intrigued. I am, it's so rare, actually, for anyone in our field to acknowledge in the addictions that smoking kills more people than any other drug. I assume that is correct. Isn't that right?
That is absolutely correct. So if you look at, so I'm going to actually give you some actual numbers here. So let me go into this.
While you're going into it, as an educator in a clinical PhD program, my students are, you know, initially really focused on do they have any drug addictions, thinking that that means cocaine, marijuana, even alcohol, and they seem surprised to hear that those are all less likely to kill a person sitting right before them prematurely than smoking cigarettes. So
right.
I hope that everyone on the line, even though we're not yet talking about sex and gender in too much detail, I hope everybody on the line walks away with at least that thought. Helping people to stop smoking is a very legitimate clinical psychology activity.
Yeah, it is actually in terms of a health prevention behavior, the number one most important change that somebody can make in order to improve their health and their longevity, by far. So just to give you some other numbers, so the annual rate of deaths due to AIDS in this country is about 18,000 a year. And, you know, we all know how much, you know, research dollars and focus is spent on AIDS. And like I said, just not to say it's not important, but, you know, tobacco use at 556,000 deaths. Annual rate of alcohol-related deaths has been pretty steady over the last number of years at about 100,000 deaths per year. And then the deaths due to illicit drug use used to be quite low, used to be around 14,000, 15,000 a year, but has recently increased, again, related to opiate use, and is more around the 100,000 mark. So even alcohol and all illicit drug use combined is at 200. Let's peg it at about 200,000 right now. So tobacco use is more than double everything else related
to it. You can count on me carrying these numbers around.
Okay.
That's great. That's terrific. And I also didn't know, and I don't know if other people knew, that women were at higher risk for the cancers you listed that are not sex-specific.
And then with regards to the sex-specific piece, so women who smoke have more estrogen deficiency disorders, are more likely to enter into menopause earlier, they're more likely to have serious pregnancy complications like preeclampsia, where the placenta abrupts or detaches from the uterine wall. They're more likely to have babies who have sudden infant death syndrome. So there's some very striking and serious consequences for women as a result of smoking.
And I'll ask you one more thing, since I get to sort of interview you here, as you can tell. You do, when you refer to sex differences, you always say sex and gender differences.
Yes.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit? Because we all know that they're not exactly the same thing. So
they're not exactly the same thing, right. So sex refers to your biological attributes. So every sex has a self. So every sex is your most basic genetic difference between people. So with regards to biological attributes, we're talking about genetic, physiological, and anatomical differences that define organisms, tissues, and cells as either female or male. So that's sex. Whereas gender happens more in your head. It's a social construct that defines, you know, appropriate roles, behaviors, and activities that identify people as either male or female.
Very good. And so I'm particularly interested. I could see how biological attributes and genetic and anatomical differences would make a difference with smoking. Are there differences by gender?
Absolutely. There are differences by gender, but it's often, when you're researching with animals, it's very clear you're dealing with sex. When you're researching humans, it becomes much more complicated because our sex is intertwined often with our gender constructs. And as we know, there's a whole sort of spectrum of how people, you know, can intersect both gender and sex. And so it becomes complicated when you're studying humans and being able to tease it apart. So much of what I've been focusing on recently is sex and gender differences in medication response. So, you know, when you find a difference, how do you tease apart what's basically due to biology versus how people view themselves as either men or women and how that intersects with how they interact with a medication response.
Very interesting. This is all the stuff I wanted to ask you at APA, but we ran out of time. So, anyone else have questions before Dr. McKee proceeds? All right, please proceed.
Okay. So the other reason that women have health disparities with regards to smoking cessation is that we've done a bit of work demonstrating that women have more difficulty quitting than men do. So not only do they have more health consequences as a result of smoking, when they try to quit smoking, they have more difficulties quitting. And we've shown these relationships in biological samples, in clinical trial samples, So pooling data across, you know, tens of thousands of people, essentially showing the difference between men and women quitting is at about a 30% difference. So women have 30% more difficulty quitting than men do, all other things being equal. So we've also looked at, this relationship also longitudinally in about 120,000 smokers. And showing that rates of nicotine dependence are not declining in women, but they are in men. So another sort of piece of evidence demonstrating that women have more difficulty quitting. Now, there's been a number of reasons identified as to why women have more difficulty quitting, and these have focused on medication response, their reproductive status and hormones, and that, how that influences their smoking behavior, how psychiatric comorbidities might intersect with smoking, and how that differences, how that differs for men and women. There's also the idea that women are more likely to smoke to manage their weight than men do, and unfortunately, nicotine does boost your metabolism by 10%, so when you look at population differences between smokers and non-smokers, smokers do weigh less, so that does happen. And something that I've been particularly interested in is the idea that women are more likely to smoke to manage stress and negative affect, and that contributes to the persistence of their smoking behavior. So what I thought I would do next is sort of go through each of those factors and talk about some of the work we've done looking at all of these risk factors for women and smoking. So with regards to medication response, there are essentially three drugs that the FDA has approved for smoking cessation. These are various forms of nicotine replacement. Bupropion, which is better known as Zyban, and varenicline, which is known as Chantix. So all three of those medications, when you look at meta-analysis, demonstrate that on those medications, women, well, let me step back. Let me rephrase that. So let's start with nicotine replacement. So there's been work and various meta-analysis showing that women do not do as well on nicotine replacement as do men. And I think the important thing to recognize about that is nicotine replacement is by far the most commonly used medication for smoking cessation, and with about 3.5 million people a year using nicotine replacement to try to quit smoking. And this is really unfortunate that, you know, this is sort of the medication that that both women and men try first. And, you know, if you're, you know, motivated for a quit attempt, try quitting smoking, and you're going to use a medication that is not as effective for you, you know, that's a really sort of discouraging outcome. So that's also the case when you look at bupropion, that overall bupropion is not as effective for women as it is for men. Now, we have done quite a bit of research and meta-analysis with varenicline, and the good news there is that varenicline, when you look at the absolute quit rates between men and women on varenicline, varenicline is as equally effective for women as it is for men. So we're really advocating that varenicline should be tried as what's called a first-line medication. It should be the first choice for women because women are going to have the greatest chance for success in if they were to take varenicline for quitting smoking. And we're just, right now the clinical guidelines for smoking cessation, they're published by Michael Fiore. The latest version actually that's still essentially current was published in 2008, so some years ago. And, you know, they have no sex or gender specific recommendations with regards to smoking cessation. So right now we're writing some position pieces that really and strongly suggest that should be changed. So just to give you some comparisons on that, you know, when we look at sort of head-to-head comparisons about varenicline, bupropion, and placebo, and when we look at how those three drugs perform in head-to-head comparisons. For men, there's no differences. All three of those drugs essentially perform equally well. But for women, the differences are striking. That varenicline far outperforms both bupropion and nicotine patch. So we feel pretty strongly about getting that message out there about the medication, the differences in medication response. So any questions about the medication piece?
Sherry, again, do you think of nicotine replacement as medication therapy?
I do, yes.
Is that one of the three? I was trying because the medications are not in my bailiwick, I guess, and so I was trying to keep track of the three. Is that one of the three, or?
Yes. So nicotine replacement. It's because you're providing nicotine, you're providing the drug. It's considered an agonist, a pure agonist treatment.
Right.
And replacement in nicotine replacement. So it's the same idea as providing methadone to a heroin user, right?
So that it's sitting on the receptor.
You're providing their. It's a harm reduction approach, right? You're providing their drug in a safer form.
So it's sitting on the receptors, so that.
Absolutely, yeah. It's a full agonist, right? So it's fully occupying and stimulating the receptor. Now, interestingly, patch. Keeps the receptor in a down-regulated state. So they get, a steady course of nicotine as opposed to cigarette smoking where you get spikes, right, because each cigarette is an acute bolus of the drug. And it's very similar to the relationship between heroin and methadone. So when you take heroin, you have a sharp, it's a bolus of the drug, you basically have activation for 4 hours, and then the drug is out of your system and you need to take, another injection of heroin, whereas methadone provides, more of a steady state, lower level response. So it's the same relationship between smoking and nicotine patch.
Very interesting. Thank you.
This is Lauren Hoffman here. I just have a quick question. Do you see any differences in the side effects of varenicline and bupropion between sexes, or are those side effects equivalent?
That's a very good question. Unfortunately, for the most part, don't have these side effects tabulated differently by sex. Now, there is a little smidge of data suggesting that that women might experience more nausea on varenicline, but that's about it with regards to available data. Even when we were doing these meta-analyses, the data did not exist separated by sex in the published papers. So we had to go back to Pfizer, who markets varenicline, and back to the individual authors and compile we were able to compile data from about just a little over 14,000 smokers for the analysis. But it was, as you can imagine, a lot of work to do that. And so part of, the work that we're doing is with these position papers is also educating the research community that they really need to publish their results separated by sex, even if it's in a supplementary table. That would be very helpful for these kinds of analysis.
Right. Thank you.
Great question.
Sherry, this is Lisa Campbell from East Carolina. I was curious about the behavioral component of smoking cessation treatment, and so the data that you're citing about the comparative effectiveness of these different medications, is that sort of controlling for the behavioral component that's encouraged, increasingly these days, or is that just looking at the medication component?
Yeah, great question. So, as you can appreciate, in clinical trials, the behavioral component will vary. But we have a recent meta-analysis that was in Preventive Medicine, and it summarized evidence about smoking cessation across various different methodologies. So we looked at clinical trials, we looked at prospective observational studies, we looked at effectiveness trials, we looked at cross-sectional investigations, and across all of this data, you see that women quit at lower rates compared to men. So I would anticipate that even in studies, if you were to pull data from studies that just looked at a behavioral treatment, that you would still see this difference between men and women.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right, so I'll move on and talk a little bit about psychiatric comorbidities. So we've done a number of studies, particularly focused on depression, and showing that women have stronger relationships between depression and smoking status than do men. So women, for example, who meet criteria for either current major depressive disorder or lifetime depressive disorder are more likely to be smokers than men who have depression diagnoses, and that having a depression diagnosis reduces your odds of quitting or of and increases your odds of relapse. So we've also sort of extended this to various laboratory investigations where we bring smokers in and either induce, a negative affect state or more of a positive affect state. And we've done this by various methods, we've done it through music, we've done it through personalized scripts about things that have stressed people out or things that people find relaxing, play these scripts during the lab session, and it's very effective at manipulating affect. And across a number of studies, we found that when we induce a negative affect, that women are more likely to start smoking faster, they smoke more cigarettes, and they smoke them what I call more intensely, so they're kind of sucking them down at a faster rate. We've also extended this and looked at, in epidemiological studies, looked at different sort of stressful events that people have experienced. So things like moving, negative health events, loss of a family member or a close friend. What else is on there? Losing a job, financial stress, etc. And across a number of studies, we have shown that financial stress in particular is very strongly related to smoking behavior in women, and that it prevents both quitting and also increases rates of relapse.
Isn't that ironic that financial stress causes or contributes to smoking or relapse, and it's expensive to smoke?
Yes, absolutely. Yep.
Sherry, do you want some more questions?
I would love some more questions.
I have one. We have a pretty good smoking nicotine addiction lab here. It's not mine, and I'm not really as familiar with smoking research as I would be if I were part of that lab, but they study minorities, and what I'm wondering is, my understanding is that minorities, particularly African Americans, have similar difficulties quitting and similar problems with smoking, and I wonder if there's an interaction effect. I wonder if I have it right, or do minorities or African Americans in particular find it more difficult to quit and have higher, have other problems with quitting. And again, if there is an interaction effect between race and sex.
Yeah, I had great question. I had a trainee who was particularly interested in those issues, and her work was focused on the difficulty of quitting in African American women. And what she was able to discern in her research is that these women were more likely to start later in life. Usually smoking starts during adolescence, but what she discovered is these African American women were more likely to start in their early 20s as sort of the stress of adult life kind of was developing and had much more difficulty quitting smoking as a result. Overall, smoking among African Americans and Latino populations as rates, they're lower than in Caucasians. And there's some unique differences. For example, African Americans are more likely to smoke menthol cigarettes, which have some unique properties, and some indication that it's more difficult to quit smoking menthols than regular cigarettes. So, yes, lots of complications, by no means a straightforward story.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, we have 20 minutes, so I don't want to keep you, but I'm going to ask you please to set aside a certain number of minutes before we hang up. I don't want to interrupt your flow, but please plan to talk to us about vaping before we end, and only because it seems like research is unfolding every single day and opinions change every single day, so I don't want to keep you from continuing to talk about your own research, but certainly even if you haven't done research on vaping, if you could talk to us about it before we have to say goodbye to you.
Yeah, I'm just, I think I had put something together on that.
And you have other stuff that you've done that we're really interested in. So it's just an area that it's hard to know what the most current research is. If you have any access, more readily access than we do, that'd be great.
Yeah, so I can talk with you. So maybe I'll just spend a couple minutes talking about, some of the medication development work that we've been doing targeting stress reactivity.
That's great.
Because, of the medications I talked about previously, they all target either nicotine reinforcement or they're targeting withdrawal symptoms. And one of the primary reasons that people smoke is to manage stress and negative affect. And again, this seems to be more of a factor for women than it is for men. So we, as part of our mission for the center grant, are particularly interested in identifying treatments and medications in this case that target stress reactivity. So we've been focusing on the noradrenergic system to target stress reactivity, and we think that this is a particularly interesting system to do that with because we know that noradrenergic pathways are involved in stress-induced relapse to drugs. There's a ton of animal studies showing this effect, but there's been very little translation of this work to humans. We also know that noradrenergic pathways are involved in dopamine release in the nucleus accumbens when somebody smokes cigarettes. So there's an interaction there. So potentially the drug might target stress reactivity. It could also potentially target nicotine-based reinforcement. So that kind of formed, a working hypothesis that we have as part of our center grant, which was to probe the noradrenergic system's effects on stress reactivity and nicotine reinforcement with the idea that different brain systems that are modulated by noradrenergic activity can be differentially activated by smoking in men and women. So for women, we're focused more on the prefrontal cortex, the amygdala axis in women, and for men, it's the mesolimbic dopamine system. And we've been doing a lot of work with guanfacine, which targets alpha-2A receptors in the noradrenergic system, and we think that this drug can preferentially target gender-sensitive systems to improve smoking cessation outcomes. So we have As part of the center, we have human laboratory studies, we have pet neuroimaging studies, we have animal studies that are all kind of interrelated, focused on looking at this medication guanfacine and how it might target stress reactivity and nicotine-based reinforcement and improve smoking cessation outcomes in men and women. And so far, I'm going to knock on wood, I'm knocking, that our results are supporting our hypothesis. So we're finding some, interesting and supportive data across all facets of the center. So in our human laboratory projects, the PET imaging and the animal studies, showing some positive data with regards to that. So I'm happy to talk about the individual findings, but I'm also cognizant of our time, and I want to leave time at the end to, for some more general discussion. So how about I leave it there and happy to answer questions. And maybe while I'm answering a couple questions, I'll pull up some stuff that I can talk to about the electronic cigarettes.
Hey, Sherry, this is Lauren again. Sorry, I'm curious, maybe I missed it, but I'm curious why you targeted those different systems dependent upon sex. So I think you mentioned mesolimbic in men and
the amygdala cortex, prefrontal cortex in women.
Right.
Yeah, so what we found, with some of the earlier pilot work that we had done with guanfacine, is that in my laboratory paradigm, I did a study where, we looked at stress-related smoking in the laboratory and then also had people quit for a brief period of time. And what I showed with guanfacine is that there was equal rates of quitting between men and women, but that guanfacine really seemed to be targeting stress reactivity in women and nicotine-related reinforcement in men.
Okay.
And that, when you look at sort of the mechanisms underlying that, so nicotine-based reinforcement is very much located in the mesolimbic dopamine system, whereas
right.
we think that stress reactivity kind of happens across the prefrontal cortex and amygdala as important brain systems sort of underlying the stress effect. And a lot of that work comes from Amy Arnston, who's here at Yale, done some very elegant molecular work showing that that stress kind of basically overwhelms your prefrontal cortex and it breaks down the connectivity. So what happens is you make bad decisions while you're under periods of stress. And we can see that in our clients and our patients, that that there's impulsive responding and bad decisions happening. And what guanfacine does is it improves, it basically attenuates that stress effect on prefrontal functioning, that you don't get the breakdown in connectivity, and that it improves decision-making abilities, improves cognitive function. So that's why we're targeting sort of the prefrontal cortex and then into the amygdala, focusing on emotional regulation and control.
Right. Very interesting. Thank you.
Thanks. Great question.
And I believe that, Lisa, did you also try to jump in?
Yeah,
right.
I was just thinking out loud that so many of our interventions, and particularly those related to substance abuse, are focusing on stress management. And it just occurred to me that behavioral stress management interventions might be a particularly good match for these medications targeting the stress reactivity system. And it also occurred to me that I'm wondering if the, behavioral programs that have been used in the past, they've been a little bit more scattershot, and that maybe there's some opportunities in the future to be pairing up sort of targeted behavioral interventions that match the same systems that the medications are also targeting.
Yeah, absolutely. Great thought. I am totally on board with that approach.
Hi, this is Catherine Holzhauer from UMass Medical School, and I was curious. I know a lot of these gender differences in stress reactivity are pertinent for alcohol use as well. I'm just curious about your thoughts on specificity to smoking versus alcohol use, for example, or if you have any ideas about that.
Yeah. You were following my, you know, my grant plan. So I think that these systems are not specific to one addiction, and I'm interested in smoking in and of itself, but because smoking is so prevalent, it also is, you know, provides sort of a nice base population to be able to look at these relationships and then extrapolate to other addictions. So I currently have a grant now to look at guanfacine to target stress reactivity in those with alcohol use disorders. So we're kind of, taking our findings that we're getting in smokers and applying them to other addictions.
Great, thanks.
Thank you.
All right, we have 10 minutes left. It's all yours, Dr. McKee.
Okay, just give me just one quick second. I wanted to pull up some.
Thank you. And in the meantime, those who are online, I believe, no, Emery's online, and David Eddy. What do we have lined up for conference calls or live podcasts for the rest of this year? Is there something do we have anything we need to announce or let people know about while Sherry's looking at her notes? Or Lauren?
No, go ahead. Noah's got the most recent information about that.
What was the question again? Sorry.
The question is about our next conference, our next live podcast.
Oh, the next live podcast, of course. How can I forget? Our next live podcast is going to be occurring just at the beginning of next month in December. It was the second, the first Friday that's happening then, and it's going to be Dr. Katie Wickowitz, who is a clinical psychologist from the University of New Mexico. It's going to be an excellent call. I would highly recommend anybody jump on.
Terrific. And we have over a dozen people. We've had anywhere between 12 and 16 people on the call today. So that's a terrific number. And in the very near future, we should actually have our new website up, our Division 50 website, and that should be able to carry the podcasts. And also... Is there anyone online who wants to, while Sherry's looking through her notes, anyone who wants to say anything about CPA? I think posters, we still have an open call for posters for the Collaborative Perspectives on Addiction Conference.
That's right. The poster submissions are open for, I want to say, at least a few more weeks. So
I'd love to
see any more.
I think it's November 16th.
That sounds right.
Yeah.
All right. So I'm all set to talk about e-cigarettes.
Thank you. Great. I really do appreciate it because it's like I said, there's a lot of press on it. There have been people who have strong opinions that it's good harm reduction
right.
As an alternative to cigarette smoking. But I would love to hear an expert like yourself weigh in on it.
Okay. So. Yes, so the harm reduction question. So the work to date has shown that individuals who go from cigarettes to e-cigarettes are no more likely to quit smoking cigarettes. What typically happens is they kind of continue to use both, and to use the e-cigarettes in situations where they're not able to smoke regular cigarettes, and that in some, there's some who think that the e-cigarette is potentially prolonging an actual cigarette use. And then there's sort of a converse of that is that there's this new cohort that are using e-cigarettes that have never used actual cigarettes. And then there's the group who are using e-cigarettes as sort of an entry into using regular cigarettes. So it's not a clear harm reduction picture. And I would say that from what we know about e-cigarettes, that they're less harmful than regular cigarettes, but it's unknown whether they're safe.
Very good. Now, just given your interests, given that they come in flavors that don't taste anything like tar and nicotine, I wonder if that'll make them more appealing to one sex over the other, or gender over the other, or even the question of minorities. Because you were saying menthol, that African Americans are more likely to smoke menthol cigarettes. I wonder if race or sex are predictors of different amounts of e-cigarette use.
The concerning thing is that the flavorings, you know, were banned. Having flavored cigarettes were banned decades ago because it was recognized as a way to make them more attractive to adolescents. And so the e-cigarette industry is sort of positioned to increase to a $10 billion industry over the next few years. And many of the large e-cigarette companies have been bought up by the cigarette companies, the companies who also own cigarettes. And they're kind of using their same playbook that they had in place, you know, 30 years ago, and reapplying it to e-cigarettes. So they have, you know, all sorts of flavorings. Right now there's several thousand flavorings on the market for e-cigarettes, and they are very appealing to adolescents. Right now there's not a huge sex difference in the rate of e-cigarette use. So right now adults, there's about 14% of men who've tried e-cigarettes versus 11% of women. Highest use is occurring in young adults, 18 to 25-year-olds. They're at about 21% use. And there's about 10% of e-cigarette users who have never smoked regular cigarettes, so it's creating a new cohort of nicotine users that didn't exist before. When you randomize... Yeah, so there's no advantage of e-cigarettes in helping quitting compared to other forms of treatment such as nicotine patch.
I think it's inevitable that we as psychologists will be asked about this, and I really appreciate your accommodating my question about it. I think that
absolutely.
Yeah. So, and I said, as I said at the beginning of the call, it's not like there's a big mob of smoking and nicotine researchers at in the field of addiction. So, thank you so much for answering.
Yeah, and I would just point people. I had written my president's column on e-cigarettes for the 2016 spring newsletter. So there's a bit of a longer write-up, and then also some resources to access to get some current information about e-cigarettes. And as you probably appreciate that it's been a polarizing issue in among researchers.
Right. Anybody else with questions in the 2 minutes we have left? I feel very happily selfish that I got to ask you all these questions. you've really educated me on a number of things that I've been curious about. Anyone else have any questions for Dr. McKee before we wrap up?
I have a question real quick. This is Noah Timmery from the University of South Dakota. I was curious to know if your center grant is using the Precision Medicine Initiative as kind of the vehicle for kind of landing such a such an excellent center grant?
It will be for the next for the renewal. We had so we're just in year five of the center grant, and so we had actually started this initiative and wrote the grant before Obama came out with his precision medicine. But I think it provides a very nice platform for what we're going to propose with the renewal.
I thought so myself. I was like, this is like word for word right out of the initiative almost. So you're,
yeah.
I think you're well poised to get
well,
further funding.
I'm going to knock on wood again. I'm knocking.
That's awesome. Well, if there are no other questions, this is my opportunity to thank you again.
It's been enjoyable. I like hearing the questions everybody has.
Wonderful. And now I know, now that you've said that you were you grew up in Canada, I understand why you say bean instead of
bin. Oh, yes. There are, you know, I've been here for 20 years, so I just said it again. There's still some differences that persist.
That's right. We have a bunch of wonderful addiction researchers from Canada, like the late and wonderful Alan Marlatt.
Yes, yep.
And aren't the Sobels also from Canada?
They are not Canadian, but they spent quite a bit of time in Toronto at the Addiction Research Foundation.
That's right, the ARF.
Yes.
Well, again, thank you so much, Dr. Sherry McKee. Thank you all for joining us for this live podcast. It has been recorded, and it will be posted. We will send out announcements for anyone who wants access to it. Dr. McKee, I hope to see you soon.
Yeah, likewise, Bruce. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.